exposure to a very complicated and highly controversial and conflicting situation. Now, we have done, we have exposed ourselves to this deliberately, because as Christians and as church people, one of the things, one of the skills that we need to learn is how to deal with these highly inflammatory issues and problems. And one of the things that I think that we will find ourselves doing today is giving careful, respectful attention to positions and points of view that at first we resist and feel hostility rising within us, resentment, that this could be. And yet we have to learn how to listen carefully and then reflect and respond in with honesty, as we can, but I think also with a kind of a perspective that we want to find how to lay hold on this problem and resolve it in the context of our Christian faith. So I'm asking Walter Press, who has been responsible for the arrangements for the day, to preside and introduce our speaker of the morning and tell us about the plans for the day and anything else that's on his mind. Walter?
Insurance farm labor has really engaged us in California for the last 9 months. It's been right in the center of our thinking. I think our board of directors spent more time, I'm confident, on the whole farm labor problem and the involvement of the church in the regular meetings in the last 12-month period than it did in, on any other one subject, which is safe to say. Well, today we've tried to arrange for you the full range of exposures. People come to this from different backgrounds. They have different insights and they have different convictions. And most of the people hold these convictions very strongly. So today we've arranged, first of all, a tour, first of all, an address by a man who can speak authoritatively from the point of view of the grower and from the point of view of the California Farm Bureau. Then two growers have arranged a very fine tour for us. We have two buses which are going to be waiting for us at 1 o'clock. Now, it's important on that subject for us to eat sharply at 12 and to be down there sharply at 1 o'clock, because we're going to miss some very fine parts of the tour if we don't get started on time. Then this evening we're going to be having a smorgasbord dinner at the Sladen House in San Jose, and there we're going to have an address by the chairman of the Migrant Ministry Committee of the Santa Clara Council of Churches, a man who has been involved in that area. And then following that, we're going to have a man who is active in organizing farm labor speak to us, several people, and we hope also some farm workers. Now, we want you to put these fellows on the spot today. They're going to give you the best presentation they can. We want you to ask key questions, to search for yourself, and I would say that your questions would cover three areas in general. First of all, the questions arising from the whole area of agriculture itself. First of all, the problems of the farmer. How the farmer sees some of the problems with which he is faced at the present time. A great many of you know that the small farmer has some very real problems. He's caught in a cost-price squeeze. He's faced with the possibility of rising wage scales, and there's a real question of whether he can pass on the rise in costs to the consumer, to the market in general, as has happened in other parts of our economy. So there are questions with respect to this. You need to ask growers questions with respect to farm labor, how they see it, the problems of having a responsible workforce at the time that they need it. The questions relating to wage scales and how you determine equitable wage scale. The question that concerns fringe benefits such as housing, the provision of housing for farm laborers. Problems arising out of the fact that farm labor is seasonal. Now, we want you to ask these people questions, searching questions in these areas, so that you may come face to face with the facts. Then the second large area, which we'll be getting into specifically this evening, is the area from the point of view of farm labor. How does this whole situation look to the man who works in the field, who sees it from that perspective? The man who lives among the people who are in a condition of poverty by and large. And Mr. Gonzalez, who is a labor organizer in San Jose, is going to be present. And he's going to have some people with him. Now the third large area is one certainly that all of you are very much interested in, and that is the role of the church, the involvement of the church. As you know, from Chris Harkmeyer's address the other evening, the church is very directly involved through the migrant ministry. The United Church of Christ has been very directly involved through the employment of Jim Drake, who at the present time is Cesar Chavez's right-hand man, and has been for over this period when the whole question has been real controversial. Now, we hope that you'll be phrasing questions in these three areas. I want to take just as little time as I can. So I'm going to introduce to you the people who are going to be with us today, who are going to be resource people. I'm going to start with a man who is not scheduled to speak, but whom we hope to bring in somewhere along the line, because he has been a grower, and now he is in the occupation of organizing farm labor. This was quite a shift. Mm-hmm. And his name is Mr. Chris Berto. He's a native son California. He grew up on a farm in Placer County. He was a grower from 1928 to 1964, raising all manner of fruit crops. Since 1964, he's been involved and interested in issues of farm labor. He has been active on the California Migrant Ministry Commission. He has attended its meetings and shared in its discussions. Since January the 1st, he has been organizing farm workers. Chris is going to be with us today and tomorrow. Chris, will you stand so people know you? We have two other people who are going to direct us on our tours this afternoon. We're really indebted to all of these people for the time and the effort that they're devoting to making this possible for us. We've got two air-conditioned buses, which they requested, so they're going to take us to places which are warm, and we're going to make it possible for them to speak as we go along. They've got a real itinerary worked out here to tell you about places of interest that we're going to pass through, and then also to speak, of course, continuingly on the problems of agriculture. The first man I want to introduce to you is Howard Harris, a state director of the California Farm Bureau Federation. He's a farmer with experience in grapes, tomatoes, apricots, walnuts, garlic, swine, cattle, grain, and prunes. That is in the large area.
I used to work with the migrant ministry, too.
Did you?
No, I'm a farmer. I'm just his reverse.
Very good. Very good. And this man on the second bus is going to be Mr. Henry J. Voss, an officer of the Santa Clara County Farm Bureau and a grower of cherries, apricots, pears, peaches, walnuts, and prunes. Will you stand?
Good morning, Voss.
I want to introduce to you Mr. Alan Grant. Some of us have learned to know Mr. Alan Grant very well. As I told you, since the past year, we've been engaged in continuing discussions, leaders in the church and growers. The first such meeting we had, I think, in last July, when Alan Grant invited 10 top growers from over the state to meet with leaders, denominational leaders, in Berkeley. We began a dialogue on this whole matter of farm problems and particularly farm labor issues. Now, Alan Grant is the president of the California Farm Bureau. He spends a great deal of his time traveling and speaking. He writes editorials almost every month for the Farm Bureau Monthly. Now, this man wasn't raised on a farm. He became a farmer by choice, he says. But at the present time, he's also a large dairy farmer. I'd like to introduce first his wife, Mrs. Alan Grant. Will you stand, please? acquainted with and dealing with problems, farm problems, for the last 37 years. Now we're going to give them a chance to talk, and I hope we'll have some time left for questions, Mr. Gray.
You don't object to take the floor, do you?
Not at all.
All right, very good. This lady has asked the question.
Those who are participating in this conference, it's a pleasure to be here, and I have participated in similar conferences through my own church. I was called to the telephone, or I would have said to Dr. Press that I would like to mention the fact that I am a Presbyterian elder.
I wanted to, and I'm sorry I didn't overlook it.
I was a Sunday school superintendent for about 7 years, and we have 5 children, and so I'm interested in the same kind of things that I think you were interested in. I might give a little bit of background as we start so that you know my wife a little bit better than you do now. My father died when I was a young man, and so I did not get a college education. I inherited 4 brothers and 2 sisters, and they have the education necessary to be engineers, which is what they are. But at that point, I started farming. Oh, my mother, I didn't think I could make enough money working for wages in the oil fields to get shoes on these brothers and sisters. And so I said, let's start farming. Because I was the nominal head of the family, she said, whatever you say is all right, but let's go. So I rented a farm on shares. I milked the cows that belonged to the landowner, not by hand. And we rented on shares. And 2 years after I started farming, moved my mother and the 2 youngest to town. My wife and I were married, and she came over and started cooking for a ready-made family, these teenage brothers. And so, she cooked for us. We washboard part of the time, but we got to the washing machine the rest of the time for 5 years. So, we have had a little experience during this part of agriculture, when agriculture was a little bit different than it is today. We were self-sustaining. We raised our own horsepower, mule power, and didn't have to buy much gasoline except to pump water because we didn't have electricity. And we raised our own feed for the mules, and we boarded the men who worked for us, and they lived right in the home with us and ate with us and the children. And so it was a little different operation than it is today. But it was interesting, and this was 1929, and for those of you, and a few of you in the room are old enough to remember that, we learned about the law of diminishing returns. And even though it was interesting, it was difficult, because if you get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to harness 28 head of mules, so that the hired man can drive them and get full 8 hours work in after they get there, and then you unharness some of them and rest their sore shoulders and so on after the hired men are all through, you know, you're putting a full day's work, particularly after you get through with that, then you want the crop. So farming then was different than it is now. But farming now has its problems too. You have a program here, and I'd just like to quote from it in order to illustrate why I take the direction I do in what I'm going to say today. To become involved in community organization programs and to reflect on our Christian responsibility in this area. To face certain major social issues and find specific ways we can work on them. And to help social action committees and church leaders develop and reflection on community, national, and world problems. All of them meritorious objectives. And I would choose to broaden my discussion today to have to do to some extent with world problems as well as those that we have right here. Because all of agriculture today knows that we don't limit our interest to the confines of that farm. That's what we did back in 1929. We were interested in that farm. As I said, it was self-sustaining. And I can well remember in about 1932 when we lived on a $10 bill for 6 weeks, and that's my wife, myself, and all of these teenage brothers. And so we were self-sustaining. We had our own food and so on. But today it's a little different. And I would like to say that farm production has to do with rural problems. Farm labor has to do with farm production. And therefore, we ought to be thinking in broader terms than we do part of the time. Today, one American farmer feeds himself and 35 other people. And back in 29 when I started, one American farmer fed himself and maybe about 10 or 11 or 12 people other than those on the farm. By 1980, Dr. Fife with International Harvester Corporation says that one American farmer must feed himself and 65 other people. That tells you a little bit about what farming has to do between now and 1980, and that's only 15 years. He has to double his production in the next 15 years. Now, my wife and I made a trip to India on a people-to-people program back in 1961, and that doesn't make us experts in India by the wildest stretch of the imagination. But we live in the Indian homes. You went last night, I understand, to live in a flophouse. We lived in Indian homes while we were there in that 6 weeks, and it might be of interest to you to know what an Indian home is like. They plaster their homes, but they don't plaster them as we do. They plaster them with cobweb. They have a covering on the floor so that it isn't just a dirt floor, but that covering is cobweb. Smear it on most wet, let it dry, and it makes it covering something like linoleum. But that's the kind of homes we lived in India while we were there, and the reason we were there was to help those people to raise their level of living. By giving them answers to questions concerning the very basic fundamentals of agriculture. And this we did, and one of the men with whom we stayed said to me, Mr. Grant, would it be possible for you to come and stay just 6 months? And we would see to it that you're well cared for, and all you would have to do would be to answer elemental questions about agriculture. So agriculture has an interest in the whole world. There's no question about it. We are interested. At the present time, India would be in a rather precarious position if it were not for American agriculture. They would be in a famine position. There's no question about that. Well, how are we going to do this? How are we going to do this thing that's required of us? You only have four countries that are going to be able to do this thing that's necessary in the world. That's Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States of America. These are the only four who are export countries. And I could speak the rest of the day on this matter, but I'd like to say that these four countries have a kind of a political climate which makes it possible for them to freely produce. You ought to keep that in the back of your mind all the time when you're thinking of different kinds of things that ought to be done. That's why I say we need to broaden our perspective and look at things from a broad view as we see what we want to get done and then see what the effect may be of certain actions. And I'm not condemning any action. I'm only saying we need to have all of the facts before we make a determination as to the direction to go. Gunnar Myrdal, who is an economist from Sweden, very eminent man, knows his subject, has said that, well, for one thing, we're going to have 245 million people in the United States by the year 2000, or 1980, and 50 million in California by that. 50 million people in California, somewhere between 42 and 50, some say 50, some say 42, by the year 2000. Well, what are you going to do with them all? The University of California says that 75% of our agriculture will be within 100 miles of Fresno by 1985, somewhere in there. 75% of the total California agriculture, and there will be no less agriculture at that time than there is now. 3.7 billion, which is a billion or a billion and a half above the next state in production in the nation, will be within 100 miles of Fresno within the lifetime of most of the people in this room. This also says something to you because the problem you're thinking about today specifically, migratory labor or farm labor, is going to be concentrated in this area. So I think we ought to think of that too. What are we thinking about? We're going to eliminate or separate the difference between a farm labor and the people that you were talking about at last night. We're going to know which are farm laborers and which are not. Gunnar Myrdal says that 1/4 of all the people who ever were born are living today. And by the year 2000, 1/2 of all of the people who ever have been born will be living. And we have 3.5 billion people today, 7 billion in the year 2000, and 9 billion in the year 2020. And there is no real reason to think that we may not have. Because birth control and all of this kind of thing takes too long to be disseminated, birth control information, for this to have a real effect in the countries where the problem will exist, which is Asia, Africa, and South America. These are the countries that are going to need the most help as far as food is concerned by that time, and we, these four countries, absolutely cannot feed those people. They must be taught to feed themselves during the same time. If we don't do this, then we become the rich uncle who refuses to help his poor city cousin, or poor cousin in Asia, Africa, or South America. This is the position that we will be in unless we learn to help those people help themselves. There would be a famine today in India if it were not for American food now, wheat and powdered milk. And when we were there in 61, the same thing was true at that time. And what's happening now? Our surplus commodities are almost gone. And therefore, there will not be the opportunity to give away the food that we have been giving to India and other countries as time goes on, as our population increases, unless the American agricultural system is able to double this production by 1980. Well, these are just some of the facts that I think we ought to have in mind as we're thinking about problems that we have here, because you and I, as Christians, have problems that go far beyond what we're talking about at the present time. Well, what are some of my experiences in this? I worked on the Christian Rural Overseas Program in my own county several years ago, and we raised the most money of anybody in the whole state of California in that county. I didn't do it. We had a committee chairman in each one of the communities, and they worked in their own communities, reported to me, and I got the credit for all this, but we had a chairman in each community, and they did the work, and I did the correlation of effort. But I am for the Christian Rural Overseas Program, but I'm also for some other things being done in those countries, otherwise they'll come up against the wall without the ability to go from there. I'm a member of the Board of Directors of Farmers and Rural Affairs. This is the organization which took us to India. And their idea is to help those people to help themselves with the information available from American farmers who go there and visit. I'm a member of the Board of Directors of Heifer Project. I don't know how many of you know what that is, but that's an organization which makes available cattle, goats, sheep, swine, honeybees, whatever is needed to war ravage for agriculture in developed areas. And it has been of significant aid in about 87 countries. I went to Japan as a housemaid, 19 head of Springer heifers back in 1956, taking care of feeding and watering all the way over there, and these were destined for orphan homes and mission schools and so on. These are agriculturally based programs. Crop, Farmers and Rural Affairs, Heifer Project, all from agriculture. This is agriculture trying to do something for other people. We have a Japanese trainee program in the Farm Bureau, and we bring 100 young Japanese to California each year, 110 or 20. Not a labor program. These young fellows live on a farm in California, now also in Oregon and Iowa, 10 in each place. They learn California ways of farming, American ways of farming, and after a year they go home. I was privileged about 3 or 4 weeks ago to go to Japan and visit the farms of 3 of these young people. And there's no question what these young people have learned to do a better job of farming than their compatriots nearby. And in addition to that, these young Japanese have taken this information, they've gone on into other parts of Asia, and they're spreading the knowledge and information that they have so as to raise the level of living and the production of food in other parts of Asia. Again, this is an agricultural program. And then we also have a similar program with Chile, 25 young men. We have a similar program with Brazil, about 22 from Brazil. And the same thing happens in these countries. Well, enough about that. These are some of the things that agriculture is trying to do outside the sphere that we're talking about here. This is trying to raise the level of living and production of food in other parts of the world, because we see in agriculture that if we don't do something like this, we won't, the world won't be able to feed its population in a very short time. And this has to be done. And we have interested the American Farm Bureau Federation in this program, and now they are going to try to broaden this thing so that we bring it clear across the whole nation and bring more young people from more countries to learn about American capabilities in agriculture. What are some of the local programs that we have? Well, we have youth crews. We have the A-Teams, which was a fiasco handled by the federal government. And so we decided that farmers ought to be able to do a better job if they were managing the thing themselves. And so we have some youth crews with the help of the school people. And these young boys do a real good job of working, providing they are managed all right, providing they have the right kind of a director with them. I can remember very well when I was, I guess, 13 years old, I worked for a Japanese farmer, and he came to me and he said, "I don't like the way you work." He said, "You pick my beans when you're here, you don't play." And this illustrates the fact that a boy has to have somebody there to oversee him and keep him on the right track. Well, we're doing this, and we're finding that the farmers are receptive to this, the boys want the job, and the boys are doing a good job. Then, with the university, we're doing some supervisory personnel training with the help of Jim Beckett of the university, and this is finding good reception among the farmers. And what it is doing, which is pleasing to me, is that it makes the worker and the employer in a better relationship, because the supervisor knows what the problems of the worker are. And together they can solve their problems, whereas if there is no good rapport between them, they don't even know what they're trying to get done. Well, in addition to that, we have tractor and forklift operator training. The Farm Bureau has worked with the university and others in this particular activity, particularly with vocational agriculture instructors. I'm a member of the Advisory Committee for Vocational Agriculture in the state of California. And I'm intimately acquainted with this particular program, and I know that it's well received both by the worker and the employer. Manpower Development and Training Act is making it possible through federal funds to do some coordinating of organizations and getting the people interested in housing. And so the Farm Bureau is working on this in Merced, up in Orland, and in Corning. Try to develop housing for employees. And this is a big job, as Dr. Chris mentioned, that some are migrants, some only work a short time, some are permanent employees, some have families, and so it is a composite of problems and not just one problem. I met with the officers of the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce the other day. And this has a direct connection with what you're talking about last night, hopefully. They started it right after the Watts riot. Too bad it wasn't before, but they started right after the Watts riot. And they have found 5,000 jobs. Jobs for pay, not leaf raking or something of that kind, but actual jobs for pay for 5,000 of the people of the Watts area. And so they wanted to meet with me because they said, is there a possibility that in agriculture we might find, after thorough screening, the kind of people who would be acceptable to work in agriculture? And I said, yes, there may be. So today I told one of our staff people to get in touch with them, to meet with them and see what we could do in finding jobs for either boys with the correct supervision or adults, whichever seems to be fitting, in order to work some of these people into agriculture. Now, there is a strong reservation on the part of many farmers concerning the area of Watts, because they've been sending buses to Watts for years and years to try to pick up day haul individuals to work in agriculture, and there is no real rapport, there is no real communication, and therefore this has not done very much good. There is no way to get a hold of the man who wants to work. They're going one street, maybe he's three streets over, doesn't even know the bus is there. even though a great deal of advertising and so on have been done, the communication is not there. So we're trying to work out something so that we may have something to offer to these people in Watts. I have a press release here dated June the 20th. And this comes from one of our efforts with the state of California in studying what are the problems in agriculture, labor-wise, mechanization-wise, and so on. So there is a committee made up of farmers and others who are studying this problem, and here is the press release which has to do with it. Half of today's farm jobs will have been eliminated through automation and mechanization by the year 1980. This is a study being made by university people, Department of Employment, Farm Bureau people, and others. This is in California. And some crops which today are harvested by men will be brought in primarily by women, according to a survey released today by the California Agricultural Training Advisory Committee. It was also pointed out that labor-saving equipment is currently available in the commercial market, or as prototype models for the harvesting of 20 different row crops, while shakers and catchers are available for 8 tree crops, and blockers, thinners, and weeders are available for row crops, operating by electronic, mechanical, flame, and chemical means. We don't grow sugar beets on our farm, we grow feed for the dairy. But two neighbors have sugar beets this year. Not once was a man in either one of those sugar beet fields. The weeds grow, but sugar beets are such a precarious crop as far as returns are concerned that the farmers did not feel justified in putting labor cost into these beets. So they, when the weeds got up too big, they put in a weed cutting machine like a mower through there with a tractor and cut off the tops of the weeds, and the field doesn't look quite so badly as it did, and that's the way it'll be handled. So this report just indicates also in other areas that men will be eliminated. The advisory committee was organized earlier this year by the California Farm Bureau Federation and the Department of Employment Farm Labor Service make recommendations on farm labor training programs and needs. The mechanization survey was developed by a special committee task force and consultants. The survey also turned up such miscellaneous labor-saving devices as power landers and hoists, hydraulic and pneumatic shears and saws, hydraulic pipe setters, that's for a sprinkler irrigation pipe for moving in, mobile conveyor units and pickup devices, hay cubers, bale loaders and stackers, precision tillage equipment, planters, bed formers and shapers, coated seed and seed tapes. The seed tape is just like an endless tape that goes through the machine, and the seed is embedded in this tape with some kind of glue, and the tape is planted rather than the seed, individual seed, and therefore the seed is planted a specific distance apart. Among labor savings calculated were these: prune shaker and catcher, 2 to 4 men to operate, replacing 25 workers. Onion harvester, 12 men to operate, replacing 40 workers. Chili pepper harvester, 2 men to operate, replacing 50 workers. And the row crop thinner, 1 man will operate it, replacing 50 to 60 workers. Information on these machines was gathered by the State Farm Labor Service for the committee to determine training needs as well as impact on the farm labor market. Some 37 dealers and manufacturers of farm equipment, the University of California, and many farmers and individuals who produce machines for farming cooperated in the survey, according to Committee Chairman Tom Richardson of the California Farm Bureau Federation. In addition to the survey report, the committee's task force reviewed farm labor service data obtained from manufacturers, which indicated that for tomatoes, a total of 774 machines will be used in the 1966 harvest, compared to 262 the year before. The task force, which met last week to review progress in determining future farm labor recruitment needs as a result of the accelerated trend toward mechanization, included the following list of people, which is in material at this time. But this, I only bring to you because this is what happened. When labor costs get up to a certain point, and I don't say too high, no, but the mere fact that economics makes its play in the agricultural field as well as in any other brings into play these kinds of things when the labor cost gets up to a certain point. And so we have a tremendous acceleration of mechanization. Now, the history over the last 15 years is, and this comes from the U.S. Department of Labor, that with every 1% increase in the cost of farm wages, you have a 2% decrease in the number of farm jobs. This is the U.S. Department of Labor information. And therefore, with the tremendous change we've had in labor costs in the last couple of years, you're going to have an escalation of this elimination of farm jobs.
So this 50% rise in wages would eliminate farm labor entirely.
Oh yes, theoretically, if you want to follow that way.
So it can't.
No, if you end up too high, it would. You're correct. It would not do that. But the what I just said was that the 15-year average has been, and so the 15-year average from now on, if it continues the same way, would do the same thing. So you won't eliminate farm labor because I think you're going to want to eat tomorrow and the next day. So we'll not eliminate it, no. Well, this illustrates, of course, the reaction that one gets from certain statements. I know a generalization is wrong because this generalization I'm making now is wrong. You just can't get facts that way. But any generalization will cause a reaction because someone is thinking from one point of view, someone else from another point of view, and so we don't get the same reaction. Well, we have a social problem for tomorrow. No question about it. We have a real social problem coming tomorrow. I served on a high school board for 15 years. I served on our elementary board out in the country for 20 years. And I can remember when we had to put on an extra teacher because we had a lot of labor move in and we had a lot of children who came to school and we just didn't have room for them. So we had to quickly get another teacher and fix some kind of separate place for it because we only had a two-room school. We put them up on the stage and put in some curtains in a hurry and got a good teacher. And we had 30 new children one day that we didn't have the day before. But we only had them for about 5 weeks. And then they went somewhere else, and so they did not get an adequate education. I'm appalled. And so I deplore that kind of thing. But we have the same social problem now that we have there. Some people who work on a farm are going to be eliminated by law. The minimum wage is going to eliminate many farm laborers. Now, maybe that's good. But we ought to know that it's going to eliminate some farm labor. There's no question about it. The minimum wage is more than the handicapped person can earn. He's not going to be there after the minimum wage is instituted. And the continuing high school dropouts are going to be an accelerating and escalating problem rather than the problem we have now. We have a problem in Watts, we have it in Oakland, we have it in every town and hamlet of the dropouts. And with the last place for these people to work, and agriculture being eliminated, then we will have this problem tomorrow, and we ought to be ready for it. We ought to be thinking about it. There's no question that what we want farm labor to be paid an adequate wage, and therefore we will eliminate some of these people, but tomorrow we will have them in the towns because we have the continuing flight to the city. In Japan, I noticed that I was there 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I was there 10 years before, taking those heifers over there. 10 years ago, we saw the water buffalo working in their rice paddies, and we saw women bending over, planting the rice. This time, we didn't see them. The water buffalo were replaced by garden tractors. The women were not in the field. The men were in the field. But we saw a few old men in the field. But the young women have had a taste of city life, and they don't wear the kimonos anymore. They wear the short skirts of Western style. And they're not about to get out of the mud in that rice field to plant rice. So they don't want to. They're not interested. We have the same thing there that we have here. In any country, you have the same revolution at the same time to a minor or a lesser degree. And so you have a farm problem in Japan, and you have a farm problem in California. But we have continuing high school dropouts. What are we going to do about it? There's no point in solving today's problem unless we look forward to tomorrow's problem at the same time and try to eliminate that also. Well, we have increased mechanization, I've outlined that, but this also makes part of this social problem tomorrow, which will be far, far worse than the social problem today. Well, the actions of today bring the results of tomorrow. No question about that, you just look back and you find that that's true. And every single individual in this room and everywhere in this country has a right and a responsibility to be actively interested in the problems. We have a right to be interested. You have a right to be interested in my problems in agriculture. I have a right to be interested in your problems in the city. But also, if you have a right to be interested in it, you have a right to responsibility in it also. And so I do say that we have a responsibility as citizens to be interested, but also the second point I'd make is that every individual has the right to all the information possible to make a decision with the right knowledge at hand. And you have a responsibility to get that information if you're going to make a decision. I don't think any Christian person has a right to make a decision unless he has all the information that he can get. And even when we've made the decision, as I might illustrate to myself, we won't know it's right. I can remember on our farm, when we were renting it, the man north of us, we have a river, runs right through the farm. No levee on one side of it, and every single year it flooded. And the man north of us put up a levee on his side of the fence because he didn't want that river to flood him. He didn't care how much it flooded me, but he didn't want it to flood him. And I thought to myself many times and condemned him in my mind, why the dickens does he have to put that levee there? Why can't he let the water flow across there? The river will go down and it won't be standing on this place and killing all the grass. And I condemned him over and over again. Then later we bought the place on time, a little down by the year, and we developed it. And we leveled that land. And we put in pipelines and we started farming. And the land on our side of the fence had been leached out, so there was no longer alkali in it. It was productive farmland, and the land on the other side of the levee was just as the Lord made it, full of alkali, and wouldn't grow any good salt grass. And here I've been condemning this man over and over and over again, and he was doing me a favor. Actually, he didn't intend to, but just the same, I was getting the benefit of that, what that man did. And so therefore I say that we don't know the truth. You don't know it. I don't know it. The Lord knows it. And someday we'll know what the truth is. But we don't know it now. And so we only act the best of our ability with whatever knowledge we have, but it behooves us to get as much knowledge as we can. I remember I used to get so aggravated with the next neighbor up the ditch. For those who are not in agriculture, I suppose most of you are not, we pump water out of the ground for part of our irrigation. We receive some water from snowmelt through a ditch. There was a man who lived above us on the ditch, and he had one share of water, and we had nine. We used the water when I first got there on nights and Sundays. He used the rest with his one share. And I went to talk to him about his taking my water, and we had quite a discussion about it over and over again. And finally he said to me, Alan, I've used that water for so many years, I just feel like it's mine, and I can't help but take it. Well, there is an admonition which says, thou shalt love the Lord thy God, and thy neighbor thyself, etc. And I could not love that man. I absolutely couldn't. But we don't have words. We speak, we visit. He's served on the same board as me, but he told me I must steal that water. And he said, steal. He said, I can't help it. I have to have it. When I need it, I'm going to take it. Well, maybe I should have batted him over the head with a shovel or something, but I didn't do it. So I just say, we don't all know what the facts are, and it behooves us to find out. And so, yes.
I'm from Hawaii, and I don't really know the agricultural situation here well. What's the labor situation?
Well, I'm going to stop now, and then you can ask all the questions you want. It's important to 12, so I'll stop right now. And I will make one announcement before I answer your question, and that is that the telephone call I got earlier was that DiGiorgio, this partly answers your question, DiGiorgio called a press conference this morning, he was making his statement stating that there was going to be a vote on Friday as to which union his workers should be represented by, and the vote was going to be taken at Borrego and Delano, and he was going to have a man from Bishop Willinger's office, because DiGiorgio is a Roman Catholic, I guess, I don't know. But anyway, a man from Bishop Willinger's office to be there, a man from the State Conciliation Mediation Services to be there, a certified public accountant firm was to be there to see that everything was done correctly. And he was making his statement, and then there was a breakup in the statement, and Mr. Kircher from the AFL-CIO broke up the meeting by shouting and so on and saying that he was not going to allow any vote for representation by the workers, and that they would bring the law into play and that no vote could be taken. Mr. DiGiorgio walked out, and so I don't know, but I can't answer you, but what is the labor situation in California? As far as Mr. DiGiorgio is concerned, I can't answer.
Do you know, sir, whether this vote was to have included the current strike breakers on DiGiorgio land or the previous workers who were on strike?
I wasn't there, so I can't answer your question specifically, but I do know that Mr. DiGiorgio has said to the NFWA, you pick the time, I don't care whether it's September, October, November, or right now, and we will get those people who were employed at that time, eliminate the others, and those will vote. So he has said that he would eliminate at any specific time the others, and they could have a vote at that time. I know that. But what I suppose the ones that are voting now are the ones that are working. But I don't know that.
Mr. Grant?
Yes.
Is not one of the objections of Cesar Chavez's group that one of the so-called unions that will have be one of the selections that people make is what they would call a company union?
Yes.
That
union is officered by labor contractors, and Cesar Chavez is not satisfied with that as a true union, and I can understand his attitude. But Mr. DiGiorgio intended to have the Teamsters, the AWOC, and NFWA, and this other one, whatever their name is, on the ballot. And the fifth point would be no union, whatever they want, whichever way they want to vote.
Didn't the Teamsters withdraw?
The Teamsters won't withdraw. They will not withdraw. The Teamsters have said that their members' livelihood is dependent upon moving agricultural products, and they will not get out of the way, and they want to be sure that there is no strike at the time that they are hauling those agricultural products. So they won't withdraw. They'll be, in fact, those who have been looking at this election are thinking that the Teamsters might win rather than NFWA.
Mr. Grant, isn't it true, though, that the Teamsters have agreed not to organize in Valeria County?
I would
respect Cesar Chavez's union as reported by the Chronicle.
The Chronicle reported that, but we get reports stating the case as I stated it. I don't know.
Withdraw even in Valeria County.
I don't know that. I can't answer for the Teamsters, but I can tell you why the Teamsters would not do such a thing, but because they have said this. Other questions? Yes?
Do you really believe that the increase in farm wages produces the decline in the number of farm workers? Or do you not believe that both of these factors are caused by the developing economy, which makes automation possible? For example, if one machine is going to replace 40 workers with 12 men, it's impossible to imagine that labor prices could go up to compete, they could stay low enough to compete with the advantage of automating such an operation.
I don't think it's a developing economy that does this. I think it is the cost of labor and the cost of the machine and the operation of the machine. And these are the two factors that are considered.
you believe that the cost of labor could be held down low enough to make it economical not to augment with the figures that you gave? If one machine will replace 40 people with 12 people, that it's possible to keep the labor cost low enough to make it not feasible to augment.
That isn't the only factor, of course, as you say, that would enter. No, it isn't the only factor. But bulk handling for grain took place right after the Civil War.
But the day
bulk handling for grain quit because of the price of labor and the price of bulk handling.
Well, you say because, that is the cause of the thing I question. For example, in the South today, they're automating cotton picking, where labor is the lowest of any place in the world.
It's still cheaper with machines.
They pick it with machines because one picker will replace 100 men. Now, how can you keep labor costs low enough to prevent the farmer from automating?
Well,
nobody's trying to. We're just saying that when it's more economical to automate, we'll automate.
Yes. Nobody wants
the implication that you're drawing from this is that we ought to keep labor costs low so that people won't automate.
No, that is. I don't mean it. See, here we illustrate again what this gentleman, how he reacted to the statement I made.
Well, what was the implication?
I didn't mean to bring that reaction from him. Your reaction is that we're trying to force people to a low wage in order to keep from automating. I believe that's what you're saying.
What I'm asking is, what was the implication of your saying, if you're making this point, that we have to understand the implications of our actions, namely that if you increase farm wages above a certain place, you're simply going to decrease the number of farm laborers.
That's correct. And you got it exactly right. No question about it. This is the result, but this is not the desire. The desire may be entirely different.
Yeah, but the question is, what are you going to do about it?
What
is your policy reaction to those facts?
The reaction to those facts is that, as I tried to say, I said it poorly, we have a social problem for tomorrow. And we, you and I, have this social problem tomorrow. We have partly ourselves brought it about. Now, what's good or bad is immaterial. That's extraneous. The fact is, it's going to be there. And whether I like to pay more money or rather pay less money is immaterial. The fact of the matter is, I'm going to pay more. And therefore, my men, instead of milking 32 cows as I did by hand, are now milking 140 cows in less time than I milk. But I put a lot of money into that dairy barn, into milking equipment, and into comfort items for the dairy, for the worker, a heater in the wintertime, a pad on the floor so it's he doesn't get so tired, all of these kinds of things. But all he does is milk. He doesn't have to feed calves or feed cows. These are the kind of changes that take place because costs go up, not because I want that barn.
I don't think what the point is of costs going up, because the costs can be, your labor costs can be half what they are, and it would still be economical for you to automate and milk.
No, it wouldn't. It would not.
Well,
it would not.
In many situations, it would. It certainly would be with the cotton picker.
No, it would not. It would not. Because people still pick cotton by hand if the price of cotton justifies it and the labor is available. No, you're absolutely wrong in this case, and that's why I say we ought to have all the information possible.
This is something that I'm well aware of, and you are too, but I think probably very few people in this room are. What's your solution to the problem of the decreasing margin between the farm production costs and returns?
This is one that each separate farmer has to answer for himself, and some farmers will go out of business, and maybe it will be. And some farmers will broaden their operations so they have a greater number of units, and even though the margin is small, they'll have enough units operated efficiently enough that they will have an operation that will stay in business. The consumer wants low-cost food. And the administration has definitely and clearly stated that they intend to keep the cost of food down. And they've stated it over and over. And so the only thing is efficiency, a greater number of units in order to increase the total profit margin, and the change from one pattern of operation into another, which is more suitable to a particular farmer, very difficult in tree crops and their vines, almost impossible. And then in addition to that, the farmer's efforts to do a better job of marketing and bargaining, and in addition to that, the development of new markets in foreign countries. So these are some of the things that we're working on in agriculture to try to minimize this problem you speak about, which just belongs to every single farmer.
I wish we had a lot more time, but I'm afraid we're going to have to cut it off, but we do want to keep our schedule.
We can continue this during the bus drive.
Yes, sure we will.
We'd love to get down to the meat of the issue here.
Oh, yes.
We'll be with you this afternoon.
We'll have two men who are as capable as you can find to do this during the bus.
And we want to express to you our appreciation for being here with us and for sharing with us your understanding.